Hello, everyone, and welcome to our third Spirituality in Dance tele-interview. This is May 19th, 2011, and I'm Lisa Michaels, your host. This interview series is brought to you by the Sacred Dance Guild at sacreddanceguild.org, where I'm currently blessed to be serving as the vice president, and my company, Natural Rhythms, which can be found on naturalrhythms.org. I'm a lifelong dancer myself, and I've gone from owning and running a 500-pupil ballet school to using conscious dance as a powerful workshop tool for the last 12 years. Through this interview series, I'm delighted to join together with people like you and the wonderful guests on this program to discuss the art of dancing our sacred prayers, increasing our consciousness and spirituality through moving our bodies. Sacred dance has told the story of the human spirit before recorded time. The Sacred Dance Guild embraces, supports, and is an advocate for dance as a sacred art. Sacred dance creates moments of awe and wonder and nourishes the souls of the givers and receivers, and in doing so helps to create a more compassionate and peaceful world. Sacred dance is dance in which connection to the divine is the intent, and the Sacred Dance Guild, through its members, has been exploring sacred dance in all its forms for 52-plus years. And we warmly invite you to dance along with us on this amazing journey by becoming a member of the Guild. So to find out all the benefits of becoming a member, go to sacreddanceguild.org. And we really appreciate you helping us spread the word about this Spirituality and Dance series, so that those who use dance to access the sacred can continue to find one another and find out more about what's happening in the sacred world of dance. And before I introduce tonight's very, very special guest, I want to remind you that our interview, our next one, will be June 16th at 7 p.m., where I'll be interviewing the co-founder of Interplay, Cynthia Wilton Henry. She's the author of 3 books on movement, and I'm really looking forward to sharing with her. But tonight's guest came to my attention when one of my friends and longtime workshop participants told me just how much she loves this woman's dance events. I mean, she was really, truly inspired and moved in many ways, and I decided as I was listening right then and there that I wanted to interview her. So we'll be talking with Dunya Diane McPherson, who is an acclaimed authority and meditative leader. She's the founder and principal teacher of the healing movement system, Dance Meditation, a path of breath and intuition. A Juilliard graduate, Sufi master, an NEA choreography fellow, Dunya's teaching credits include Princeton University, Swarthmore College, New York University, Barnard College, New York Open Center, Kropala Center for Yoga, Netherlands Mystic Festival. Dunya has her MA in writing and is the author of Skin of Glass, Finding Spirit in the Flesh, a memoir about dance as a spiritual path. Welcome, Dunya. I'm delighted to be connecting with you tonight.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you. And so I just really want to start out by finding a little bit about, you know, how did you become involved in dance as a spiritual path?
Well, I was dancing along as a young artist. Doing that path with a great deal of intention and satisfaction. As you mentioned in my bio earlier, I was a professional dancer, and I had a lot of expectation that art would take me all the way to a full sense of self-realization. That was sort of what my background had led me to believe, that, you know, art was sort of the place that a person can go in this culture, really. Because in my early childhood, spirituality was really associated with religion, and it didn't have the same place for me. So I was going along in dance and kind of reached a pinnacle, you know, dancing, performing and teaching in New York City at a time when it was just a hotbed of fabulous art and feeling quite empty.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a series of injuries, and, of course, that's all of the time of ultimate crisis, especially if you're a performer, in which everything was called into question. And at that time, I was fortunate enough to meet a Sufi teacher. And so that was the turning point. I really had no idea what would happen from that turning point, but I had an experience fairly immediately upon, you know, doing a workshop with this teacher where I had a heart opening and I felt that I'd come home. And then my work took a radical shift from that point on. So that's how I found the path. Just actually serendipity, another dancer took me to a workshop, and it just, it was like one of those huge openings that happened.
Well, it sounds like from the very, very beginning that this connection to being into Sufism really impacted you. So I'd love to know more about what it was in your journey in relation to that that really opened you up so much.
That's a wonderful question. I think what had happened for me as a professional dancer was that my being was very tightly held deep inside, and I would craft this really beautiful external vision. You know, that's what a dancer does, makes beautiful, you know, crafts the body to be a certain shape and to do beautiful movements. And, you know, it was persona, and the real me was very deep inside and hidden, and, you know, all my energy went into making this exterior me. And when I actually first encountered Sufism, it really was nothing about the outside. I mean, for one thing, you know, you close your eyes and you move. And all of a sudden, I was feeling my movement. I was feeling who I was. And I was realizing that I couldn't feel myself at all, actually. That was the big crisis, was that when I moved, I had no sensation. My body was quite numb. And I couldn't feel my breath, my mind was very scattered, all of the things that usually come up for new meditators. But this was, for me, very fortunately, a Sufi teacher that used movement. So I was doing this process in movement. I wasn't sitting and chanting, or, you know, I would never have been probably attracted to a practice like that. I was actually doing, you know, movement and dance and music and things that looked familiar to me and felt familiar, but what I was doing inside of them was very different. And so I began to find how alienated I was from anything authentic about myself. I was very used to controlling who I was to the world. And then suddenly I was on a path where I was discovering myself. And it was rather lovely. I was on my little blanket doing my meditative work, and other people in the room were doing their little things, so it was sort of companionable in a private way, but it wasn't austere or, you know, monastic, but the encounters were quite huge. So, I mean, that's maybe sort of a picture.
Well, so let me ask you a question that around that. Had you been doing any spiritual practice before that time?
No. In fact, it's a strange thing now. You know how things make sense to you in retrospect, but at the time, you know, didn't have any place. I had moments from the time I was a child where I would be in the moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would be suddenly really present, and I would feel that this was something wonderful, but I had no context, you know, because I didn't come from a culture that ever talked about it or had a place for it. You know, it was just before this, you know, this was in the 70s or the 60s when I was growing up. It wasn't like now where everybody has heard about this.
Right.
So I was, it was an experience. And, you know, in other words, I was open spiritually, but I didn't really have anything to do with it particularly. And then I found myself as, you know, spiritual teachers became a little bit, you know, came over to the West and they were teaching more publicly. I found myself looking into yoga and different forms and having a bit of a search, and would sort of open immediately, but because I didn't have a teacher, I would sort of read books and things, And because I was professionally a dancer, I didn't really pursue it, and I didn't know what to do with it. So
mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm saying is I had a hunger, but
right.
I didn't have any support for the hunger.
Right.
And it wasn't until I found a teacher, and that teacher had quite a strong following, that I realized this was something to do and that I was not going to have to, you know, I was going to have support doing it. And also, as soon as I started doing it, it was really no question for me in my heart of hearts that I knew that this was the direction I needed to go. Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So how long really was the, I mean, not that the journey's ever over, because there's those so many more deeper, meaningful layers that we always get to enter into. But up to this point, like from the time you started till now, how many years are we talking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, 30, 35 years. I mean, I always think of it as that I had about, you know, 17 years training in professional dance, you know, starting from the time I was kind of an eight-year-old, something like this.
Right.
And then I had about 17 or 18 years training in Sufism with my teacher. And when I say training, I would do at least a two-month retreat every summer, as well as long retreat chunks like weeks or 10 days during the year. So it was
wow.
substantial training.
It yeah.
wasn't just a little here and there. You know, I was really in it. And at one point I moved to the Sufi camp and lived there, so even though he wasn't teaching all the time, I was really working on my practices even when he wasn't there. So, yeah, so I sort of had 17 years in ballet and modern and 17 years in Sufism, and then, you know, I taught for my teacher. I was one of his teachers for quite a long time, and he always encouraged that in me. And then I finally went on to teach my own work and develop my own work, which is still, you know, highly informed by everything that I've done there, I did there, but it also included elements that he didn't include, as is who I am. So I don't know, really. I mean, that's
yeah.
a really good question. I would say 30 years.
Long time.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So I'm really fascinated by dance meditation, which is your work, and you know, knowing a little bit more about how you developed it through these many years of, and I know how things grow on the inside while you're doing them. So I'm sure that had to be part of that journey, and I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, I liken the process of, you know, developing a form to life. You know, if I'm a choreographer, for instance, a choreographer can make a dance from two directions. You know, she can either invent a lot of movements and then put them together, you know, in a formalistic way, or you know, she could, I'm talking about two ends of the spectrum, or she can kind of keep improvising something till it sets itself. Those are sort of the two ends of how something comes into being in terms of making a dance. Well, this is not making a dance. Dance meditation, however, was much more evolutionary. It's much more like you just kind of keep doing it until it becomes clear what it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But there were, you know, several arenas that were very important to me. And so when I now step back, because it seems to have, these keep coming back, these three resources or you know, resource works keep coming back and keep coming back, you know. So I would sort of say that dance meditation is sort of, in a molecular way, like the nucleus of it is Sufi mysticism. That's its core. And I think of the mystic heart as being associated with the unity state the non-duality, the solution of identity with things. And then circling around that would be somatics, which have to do with sensation and incarnation, and the precognitive. And then the work orbiting around that, the most superficial layer would be art, which is the expression and the unconscious, and beauty. and of course, these three levels, I mean, I'm kind of putting them in a level-like way. It's not really how we are. or we move from an inner to an outer and we pass through different levels. And sometimes you have to open the door in one level for another level to open up. And so it isn't hierarchic so much as it's a feeling sense that I have that somehow the deepest inner core of the work is mystical. But I value very much how somatics and art can open doorways into that, because it can be rather illusory
right.
to find that mystic center. It's not more grace-like when it opens to you. So all these doorways are good. And the things that sort of called for, there are many things that they're lovely but only happen once, but then there's some things that keep coming back and coming back, and they continue to be wonderful ways to access internet, you know. But I would sort of define them as coming from art, you know, what I knew as an artist. And the same with somatics. So somatics being more about, you know, feeling the body and, you know, different sensation-based work, connecting cellularly.
Wow, it sounds amazing. And what it leads me to a question of really, what exactly is being a Sufi or Sufism? I mean, you know, what at the core is that?
Well, it's interesting because I am, you know, I would define myself as a Sufi, but I don't think that people that necessarily train with me would necessarily have to do that at all, even if they train with me a long time. You know, they can define themselves however they feel. But the spiritual lineage of the flow of love and the kind of eternal connection, that lineage in me is Sufism, because I received that from my teacher. And so I feel that, you know, people will probably, my students will probably receive that from me too.
Mm-hmm.
But how it works for them, I don't really know. You know, that's not really my my role.
Mm-hmm.
So my role is simply to open the door. So I could say in the outside way, Sufi is associated with as being the mystical heart of Islam, but it's really many people, many of us, prefer to say that it sort of predates contact, that mysticism has always been a force in humans, and which is this intimate contact with the divine, which you disappear into the unity state.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow in mysticism, there's this feeling of there is a divine entity or process or quality, you know, versus Buddhism, which might not use that as its, you know, connection to meditative work. But in Sufism, there is a feeling like, you know, that, or at least in mysticism, that, you know, you are the divine, but you're not the divine. So part of my seeking is always that I feel what I'm reaching toward, and then I sometimes am there, and then I'm not, because I'm completely subsumed in. I would say that that is a lot of the mystical process, and that's the deepest place within this work, you know, and just using movement and dance to find that, you know, is the way in.
So when someone comes to you and they're starting on this journey and they're really opening to have this experience, you know, how do you lead them in? Like, what is the process of really getting them connected and helping them to, like, really learn to listen to their body and to find that inner place? How do you do that with them?
Well, it's really easy, actually. It's really accessible to go, you know, to begin. I think partly because everybody sort of wants to be connected more to their body, really, even if they don't know it.
Right.
But the kind of, how it looks, what it looks like from the outside is that I tend to lead, this is usually how it works. I will lead movement, and it's sort of repetitive. So, for instance, I'll just give maybe sort of example that, you know, I'd inhale and lift my arms, and I'd exhale and bring them down. And something very simple and easy that somebody can follow me with their eyes open, and I don't really talk, I don't use any words. And there's music, and so there's a lulling and gentle quality to it, and the repetition sort of gradually evolves, follow, so the mind can relax, so the part of the person that's sort of tends to be questioning and judgmental or fragmented or whatever, you know, and how we all are when we come into a meditation process. And, you know, so that can finally settle down. And, you know, gradually people get more and more connected to their breath and their movement, because I do give cues about, you know, the breathing process with the movement. And it gradually develops over time, and then I'll cue them to close their eyes and just their movement from themselves, you know. I'm giving different kinds of cues, but it's always something serviceful, but like a mantra, something that your mind attaches itself to and it tries to stay with it, you know. So it might be, you know, keep your mind on your breath as you move, or let your mind follow your movement rather than lead it. And actually, so let me just go off on that tangent for a minute. A lot of what I am trying initially with most people is to get them into a more receptive place with their movement relationship, with their relationship to the body. And that means the mind is very engaged and present, but it's not telling the body what to do.
Right.
So there's sort of two different, I'm going to go to the extremes again, of the mind-body relationship. The mind can, and this is how most of us do know our mind-body relationship. One is, mind tells the body what to do, you know, like, move this, do that. The other is, the mind abdicates and goes off, and you're in a big trance, and you have no idea what's going on. So this is right in the middle of that.
Ah.
So the mind is engaged, but its role is to bear witness and to be conscious to the body's process, to respect, but to be curious, maybe my quality. I try to engender that by how I'm reading. Because the mind is a wordy thing.
Right.
So doing a mirroring, a leading, and following is a much more body-to-body kind of experience.
Hmm.
And that helps people's bodies, it helps people connect into their body and let the mind go. And then I think also this process of following somebody else, what happens is that the modeling is set up inside the self. So when a person closes her eyes or his eyes, they are following their own movement because they've been following my movement. Or they might do it with one another, like one person might lead the other follow. But it's to set up this idea of followingness rather than leadingness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really love that intersection. I'll have to experience it sometime, because I definitely have done both the mind telling the body what to do and then the body, like, really just surrendering into the movement. So this place where there's the intersection between the two of them in a different way, that just really sounds beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I think so.
Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, it is really beautiful, and I think that something about, I guess what I'm trying to distinguish when I talk about and trance work is that in this system, in dance meditation and its sort of parent Sufism, we're really not trying to get to a place of ecstasy in the Greek root way, okay, because the Greek root is ekstasis, which means out of the body.
Mm-hmm.
What the word in Arabic would be is lishud, which means finding and intensity.
Say that one more time, Dunya. Finding what?
Right. And intensity.
Uh-huh.
So what we're seeking is a deepening of an innerness. And eventually the mind will kind of get very quiet and it will, in fact, sort of dissolve back. But to, you know, the arrival at this deeper inner state, you know, if you're just kind of going off into a trance, it can be quite digressive and actually not. You know, this is really a cultivation of a strong meditative capacity.
Mm-hmm.
To be very focused, to be highly apperceptive, to be very, very aware, at the same time to be beyond the beyond. So I have to say that, you know, when I trained in this, I didn't really realize that there were many different ways to meditate, different intentions and different types of development. So I was just following what was my teacher was teaching and what I felt was unfolding for me. But of course, over time, I did other different processes, and for me, this was the one that was the most centering, the most stabilizing, the most cultivating of an increasingly fascinating existence in the world. It did some kind of integration that I really have no idea how that is, truly, but I mean, I could probably say things about it, but there's something deeply, deeply integrative about being able to focus at the same time let go.
Oh, I bet.
So we've gone to some pretty deep conversation here, but thank you for letting me go there. That's lovely.
I like to go there.
I know.
Yeah, I really think it sounds wonderful.
Well, you know, there's maybe being a child of the 60s and 70s, there was an awful lot of, just like, you know, kind of raving and dancing and being drugged out and being, like, out there and, you know, cosmic. And, it has some of that joy, but it also has a much larger picture, you know. It's sort of, it's not chaotic. It's quite
right.
Elegant and cultivating, and yet it has profound reach.
Right. You know, one of the things that I really felt after years of studying ballet was that honestly, ballet gave me a consciousness container to really be able to hold structure and form in a really powerful way. And it sounds like this gives an intersection in terms of focus of the mind's capacity to really be present with what is happening in a whole new way of being around it. In the same way that if you're really looking at ballet from a consciousness perspective, that it provides from a different angle. One is forming, and one is like with just what you said, the letting go.
Mm-hmm. A nice allegory, or analogy. I think that art, when you get beyond just being able to actually, especially like ballet, just do the movement, you know, what you see underneath is this beautiful abstract, this abstract beauty, or beautiful abstraction, you know, which is certainly the appeal of art, and it is a kind of doorway to a certain kind of higher consciousness.
Yeah, definitely.
Structure of the universe there, and I mean that's what artists do, right?
Right.
And this would be maybe the mystical experience would have more to do with an intuitive leap,
mm-hmm.
an intuitive pathway versus sort of a more, I hesitate to use the word analytical because it's not really, art isn't really analytical, but it does have that formalistic structure associated with analysis. But this is a more mystical experience. It's highly intuitive. And, you know, you put things together when you return back from the state that you really had no idea could come together.
Yeah, that's the piece.
You couldn't really see.
Wow.
And you feel, too. I mean, the heart opens in ways that really couldn't open before, you know.
Nice. Nice. Oh, it sounds fantastic. Now, I'm fascinated by, number one, just the title of your book. I love it. Skin of Glass, Finding Spirit in the Flesh. I mean, what a phenomenal title. So tell me, like, what happened on the journey? I've written a book myself, and I know it is a journey. So tell me about your book and your journey with it.
Oh, thank you for that invitation. Yeah, it's a journey, no question. Yeah, I initially really had wanted, and I still want, to write, you know, I wanted to write a series of essays about dance meditation, about practice and some experiences. And, you know, that's really how I started out. And then pretty quickly into it, it said, oh, no, you know, this is going to be something different. And so, and then I remembered that what I loved to read was spiritual memoir. And I thought, okay, let's follow that and see where it goes. And how I decided to pursue it, which is a very non-conventional way to pursue memoir, is to do my practice over the course of a year and, say, spend 3 months every day just focusing on my legs and then 3 months just focusing on my spine. You know, so I would go into the studio every day and I would just work with my spine, and then I would journal. And so I used that material as my research. And so the book has kind of got a traditional beginning where I talk about my training in both, you know, ballet and then in Sufism. And then the meat of the book is really called Body Parts, in which I sort of explored these different body parts, and this narrative emerged from having this exploration process. And I was really quite shocked after I did this set of practice periods and journaling that there was a narrative. You know, I really didn't know what would come up. But when I stepped back, I said, wow, this is actually a story. And my body really wanted to tell this story.
Wow.
So that's, it turned into memoir quite organically from, instead of, you know, starting one place and end up in memoir. And of course, the thing about a memoir is it's not an autobiography. The point of writing about your experience is to tell the reason, you know, tell the piece of experience and then what you learn from it. I mean, that's essentially what memoirs do. So you could be a memoirist and write, you know, a segment just about your relationship to your mother, or, you know, about your time in Italy or whatever. So this was really specifically about this period of time in my practice and what it feels like to have dance as a spiritual path. I'm sure I could write another, really, truly focusing in a slightly different way. But the other thing that happened to me as I was writing the memoir was that really for memoir to be effective is you have to be honest.
Right.
And that was quite shocking to me. Certain things were very easy to be honest about, and some things were very troubling, very painful. You know, I went through quite a lot of change as I was writing the piece. And then I finally had to step back and get reflective enough to put it into a form that wasn't, you know, self-indulgent and annoying
right.
to read. And then the final challenge was, because I was writing so much about sensation and movement, was finding a language that felt that there was a felt sense for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really want it just to be like, you know, I had read some wonderful autobiographies from dancers, you know, Gelty Kirkland and different people, but they could have been plumbers for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You really didn't feel they were dancers, you know. And I thought, I really want my reader to feel what it's like to be in the body as I do, you know, as I'm, you know. So that, interestingly enough, my language model turned out to be a wonderful poet, Gretel Erlich, who wrote a beautiful book about 5 seasons that she spent in Greenland. And this book called This Cold Heaven is really mostly about snow and ice and traveling across Greenland. And I realized I was going to use that idea of traveling through my body and the landscape of that and the felt type of landscape. So, you know, it was quite a journey just to come up with this book in this way. Both a personal journey and a literary journey, you know, to find the
right
expression.
Right. And it's such a blend, those two.
Yeah.
So I really want to hear about a body part. I want to hear about a discovery that was made from inside your body and what a body part had to say to you that you really found meaning in?
Well, every body part has a lot going on. These were the four that I ended up using, and clearly it could be any four. Well, one was legs and feet, one was spine, one was ovaries, and the other was skin. So you could imagine you could write a wonderful piece just on hands or on, you know,
right,
the breasts, or, you know, the back of the neck, you know. So really, these were the ones that for some reason I settled on. And there was tremendous, legs and feet, like one interesting discovery that I had no idea was in there was that my legs and feet were very connected to my mother. Now, you would think, everybody thinks, oh, it's the ovaries and the uterus. No, my mother was in my legs and feet. And one of the things that came to me was that my mother, when she was a child, had rheumatic fever and was in bed for a year and didn't walk. And
wow.
She had to learn how to walk all over again.
Wow.
And I felt often when I was a child with my mother growing up, but I didn't know this till I did my practice, that I was trying to protect my mother and help her, you know, like pick her up and run with her because she couldn't walk.
Right.
And it's so interesting because, you know, she told me that story and my grandmother told me the story and everything, but I didn't know until I went into my legs and feet that my mother was in there.
Mm.
And I felt her reality, you know, because you don't really know how you take on your parents and,
right,
you know, where they reside in you. And it was completely unexpected. So there's just one little piece, you know, of realization that came to me that I would never have found through any other conventional mean, even through therapy, nothing. You know, it was really a felt, embodied kind of experience.
Right. And the body holds all of that, and how fabulous to give it the opportunity to speak to you in that way and to really inform your life. I love it. Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing.
So do you train teachers?
Yeah, I've been teaching well, it's now an annual summer retreat, a two-week retreat. It's had slightly different forms over the time, but I began doing a teacher training process about 20 years ago because, well, it was actually at the request of one of my students who's a marvelous dancer and, of course, is teaching this in Austin, Texas. And she said, why don't you do a teacher training because I'd really like to be in a longer process with you rather than just, you know, weekend retreats or little five-day retreats. You know, I want an ongoing thing. And so I kind of figured out what would I consider, you know, to be a teacher training process. And interestingly enough, that the initial thing that I set up has continued on, which is an 80-day retreat, 80 retreat days with me over a course of 4 years. That has turned out to be a pretty good process, I mean, through the test of time. And now I do the majority of the training time at this two-week annual retreat, and then people fill in the amounts with other long retreats like at Kripal and different places. But it allowed, you know, students and people who have sort of serious intentions and want to go beyond just a temporary experience to have a longer time, a more committed time, and to go through an arc of experience, because with any deep work, you know, you have phases. So you feel like first the honeymoon, and then you have like the resistance. And
right.
80 days of retreat kind of gets you through at least one cycle of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happened, though, over the 20 years is that I've trained quite a few teachers. I'd say, you know, 25, 30 people have completed the program. Many people have come in and out of it, and many people participate, but they don't either do long full certifications or anything. But over this time, the group has developed into being, you know, some really more dedicated practitioners. And so I kind of feel we've moved away from it being a teacher certification more to an in-depth training certification.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to teach at the end of it and it's the right thing, then you have a conversation. So that's kind of not sitting in the way as like the, I mean, sometimes you need a carrot in front of you,
right,
on the stick, but sometimes it actually impedes letting go of an ego identity to a thing. So, I mean, people go back and forth with those things. I mean, it's good to, you know, to acknowledge one's achievement. At the same time, it's not good to acknowledge it so much that you stop growing.
Right.
So, but anyway, we have practitioners that have moved, you know, certainly beyond that phase, and they're moving much more into the path, which is a long thing. You know, I think in Sufism they say that you train with your teacher 1,001 days, and which I did. And interestingly enough, I did train 1,001 days with my teacher or more, and there was this sort of natural feeling of completeness. Not that he said anything or I, you know, asked about it, but because he never had any formal structure to his. It was just, you know, you work, you do the work, you do the work. And there was no, like, patting you on the back that you reached 80 days of anything, you know.
Right.
But I felt it. I felt
yeah.
It. And then later, many years later, when I read that, oh, the traditional training in Sufism is 1,001 days, that was kind of funny. I went back and counted up, and I went, like, oh, it was around that time when I felt that it was time for me to develop some of my own work and move away. So, but it's certainly path. By that time, it's really path, you know, what that means, and you know your own, you know your dark nights of the soul, you know your boredoms of the soul, you know your elevations of the soul, you know you've been through it enough to not be very sidetracked by any of those pieces of internal weather,
mm-hmm.
you know, to just continue and see what's next.
I love that term, internal weather. That is a great way to describe it.
Right?
Yes. Wow, that's fabulous. So when people teach your system, like, what does that actually mean?
There's sort of two levels. You know, there's the outside part where they're doing kind of like a little bit of description that I described to you earlier. You know, they lead movement processes, and part of the trainings is that I do some kinds of sequences, you know, enough so that people have sequences to hang on to. So when they go home, they have something like, you know, like a sun salutation. They have it. Oh, I've done this sequence enough times, so it's in my body, and
right.
It's within this state. So I can find the state again by going to the sequence.
That's great.
But ultimately what they're trying to do, and the more they become developed as teachers, they'll be much more comfortable in it, is to follow intuitively the movement that's opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is harder than it sounds to do in front of a group of people when you're leading them. I mean, it's quite difficult. You have to, first of all, you have to really pay attention to the moment. And if you go into your head and into your ego, the whole, you know, everybody can feel it, you can feel it, you know, you just,
right.
You have to be really open to what is unfolding. And at the same time, you know, for really developed teachers, they also really know the arc of the hour and a half or the 3 hours or whatever it is you're teaching. So they can feel I'll use a Buddhist term, the mind of the room. It's really not the mind of the room, it's the state of the room. They can feel the state of the room of everybody deepening. And so they're modulating the depth of concentration by how they're leading and what they're leading and what they're offering. You know, like, for instance, when I'm teaching and I'm leading, I can deepen my concentration. But oftentimes I can feel that there's a little bit of a wall, and I know it's not my wall. Sometimes it's the wall of the group. You know, they can't. Now, then they need time when they close their eyes and they just process, you know, so then I'll let them do that. Partly because following somebody else is, in a way, it's constrictive. You know, it's like repeating a mantra. You have to stay with something else rather than letting something happen. So it's, you know, There's a balance between them following me and then doing their process, or them working on a movement idea and then relaxing and letting go, you know, and all of those things gradually let people sink farther and farther down into themselves. And at the end, bringing people back out. So a lot of this is the teaching, learning how to do that is quite a long process. First of all, you have to experience those things with yourself, and then you have to come to a place where you can conduct them.
Sure. Wow. So no wonder it takes them 80 days.
Sure, yeah.
Absolutely, at least, because that it's just it just sounds like a tremendous process of really accessing more and more layers.
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. But the beauty of it is when you're teaching a system like this, you're not teaching something that will ever be finite. You'll always be growing. And
right.
So it's always a benefit to you as a teacher.
Right.
And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, and you know as a ballet teacher, I know as a ballet teacher, I taught in ballet and university system, like, you know, there's a syllabus, and, you know, there's a limit to that. You know, there's a certain point you get your students to the point where they can do their triple pirouettes and their four and layer, and that's that. That's all there is.
Right.
There ain't no more. And so this, it's not easy to do, and it takes 10 years to make it a dancer, but, you know, there is a finite piece of system, but this is pretty much as infinite as the human condition, you know, as the human being.
Nice, nice.
As infinite as the person. So
mm-hmm.
There's always growth.
Okay, well, this is a really wild question. I'd studied spirituality for, you know, most of my adult life, and not a moving practice like yours, but I always was, like, looking for this blend of the spirituality and where it meets the movement. And I love how you're applying it in meditation, and I'm just curious if you ever took any of that and went back to ballet from a whole nother perspective, and was there any level of integration if you even played with that or not?
It's a great question. I think there was a period of time when I was first working with the Sufi teacher, but I was still, my job in the, you know, regular year was I was teaching ballet in colleges, you know, universities. So I was sort of in two different worlds at the same time. And, oh, of course, it tremendously helped. I mean, I didn't really have, when I would go back in to teach ballet or to take ballet class, I didn't feel, a spiritual state. In other words, I didn't feel any altered state. But what I did have was a far more connected experience inside my body. You know, it was like I could hit those balances like I'd never been able to hit.
Yeah.
Them. It was much more tuned in, you know. And but because there's really no devotional element to this mystical practice, you know, it really is about connecting into the body and into the energy, into the breath. So those things are all highly relevant to the athletic quality of ballet as an art, you know. Sort of, it's just that your eyes are always open when you're doing ballet, and you've got a lot to pay attention to, you know, to get into arabesque and to,
right.
You know, hit the pirouette, so that, you know, you're certainly one-pointed, but it's just a lot to manage. Those movements are very,
right.
A lot to manage. I just found that though I was more tuned, I was more aligned and more tuned in.
Yeah, that's great. I just think there needs to be at some point, and it would just be fascinating to see if it ever does evolve, that, you know, a whole art of ballet needs a deepening spiritual component to really bring the dancer back to that place within the body. So I'm just delighted to hear of your experience with it.
Yeah, I wonder. Maybe there are some people who are really working on that. I mean, I did eventually sort of abandon ballet as a pursuit, but I do think it would be a wonderful thing for, you know, for somebody to work on that, you know, rather than, I mean, you know, my training, I'm from the era where it was fairly abusive. You know,
right,
really.
Right, right.
Things to the body. I'm sure there's a much more effective and tuned in way to teach it. And I know people are doing that.
Right.
I don't know how much it really would lead to a meditative reality or a mystical reality. I don't know the potential of ballet, but I guess that's partly your question. But it is. I know there are people that are certainly teaching it from a less abusive,
right,
you know,
right,
platform.
We had a fascinating teacher at the last Sacred Dance Guild Festival David Taylor. He's out of Colorado, and he has a sacred dance ballet company. And it is just, he was just amazing. I think it would be just a wonderful connection for you to just witness and to, you know, have that conversation, because these are the things, I don't know, these are the things that fascinate me in life. So, I can't even remember all the things that he did, but the movements, like we did a Syrian morning dance where, in the movements that he taught us, you could truly feel, you know, the consciousness, like, really connecting to this aspect of the women, like, really helping the consciousness transition in mourning. I mean, it, you could feel it in the movement. So I think there's a layer of these connections that probably were way more present that we're continuing to unfold back into and really remember and access further. And the things like that you're doing with dance meditation, it's just such a powerful way of really accessing what needs to be connected, you know, is available for that deep connection. So it's truly beautiful.
Well, you know, we're all embodied. You know, we live in a disembodying culture now, but you know, dance all came from the fact that it came out of the body, and the body was an instrument that was much, I think, in other cultural times, in other periods, was much more in everybody's consciousness. I think that, you know, it's just now as we move, you know, more and more into a technological world that people are being more disembodied, so we have to find our way back. But
yeah,
it doesn't surprise me at all that people go into sort of more ancient forms and then they find tremendous consciousness, like the teacher that I studied Sufi with was, you know, Iraqi, and so when he would lead dancing, he was leading belly dancing, and, you know, those movements are really nature-based movements. They're, you know, all this vibration and undulation, and these are things that you look at in water and in snakes and trees and the wind and little dogs shaking and everything, and, you know, all of a sudden you feel this tremendous resonance with the world around you as you're moving, and, yeah, so absolutely, there's a consciousness in movement that connects you to a larger universe. There's no question of that.
Yeah.
I just know for myself that I've had times where the form of the movement has been tremendously inspiring, and then times when the form drops away and any form could take me in, you know. So,
right.
Not any form, but, you know, it's surprising what does take me in. So it's interesting. I never like to get too set in saying this is
right.
It, because then as soon as I say this is it, it changes.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyway.
Right.
But, you know.
And there's a lot of ways in, absolutely. Right.
Really.
So what's in the future for you? Like, what's next?
Well, I'm in a really wonderful juncture of, I have a couple of projects, but one, you know, facilitates the other, is I bought a beautiful property in New Mexico, quite remote, because I've been teaching at retreat centers, which are, for the most part, you know, they're retreat centers, but they're not very terribly retreatful. You know, sometimes they're very close to a town or in a town or, you know, very, you feel civilization very close at hand, and that's mainly what I've been doing for 20 years, and I really felt that I wanted to be in a place that was, you know, where you just really couldn't hear airplanes and traffic, and you couldn't get a candy bar if you just were, you're in the mood for it, you know, where the air was really clean, where, you know, there was a lot of quiet, and wind, so I went ahead and found a property in New Mexico, and so I'm developing, I really just purchased it, so I'm spending time on it now to see exactly what will happen, but, you know, I anticipate being able to teach retreat from there, at least for those who are hardy and want quite a monastic experience, and can partner with some retreat centers in New Mexico that aren't too far away, but that are more like, you know, comfortable for people who need that sort of support. So I could do one piece of retreat at that center and then another in a much more remote setting, depending on, you know, the intention of the retreat. So this is sort of a new phase for me. It's sort of moving. I think it's going to help move the work into another level of subtlety. I mean, that's certainly my intuition, and that's what's driving me toward it. And it's also a place where I can find some time myself to write, do more writing. I want to work on another book and hear more deeply.
Right.
Part of me is that I feel when I'm, I've been based in New York for many years, and that may become, I don't know, but there's almost so much cacophony, and I get distracted that I'm not really, even though one shouldn't be, one should always be focused, you know, if you have a deep practice, but there is part of my body that needs to hear on a subtler level, and
mm-hmm.
there's a need to have a little less ambient noise for that. So that's my next project, and it's kind of a big project, I think. But, you know, it seems to be flowing quite wonderfully. And then in sort of the most immediate sense, you know, I continue to teach at the College Center, and I continue to offer my summer monastery, my local monastery, every year. And it's just a wonderful period of time. I just love the people that come. They're just so incredible. They're so inspiring to be with, and I'm very grateful. I have such terrific people that come to do this work.
And so please tell us your website and tell people how they can get in touch with you and anything else they need to know to really have an experience of your work.
My website is dancemeditation.org, dancemeditation.org, and, you know, pretty much if you Google Dunya or implementation, it comes up pretty quickly, but that's the website, and I have instructional DVDs, you know, at least if you'd like to have a taste of what you might experience in a workshop, you can get a DVD, and, you know, I conduct those not terribly differently from how I would do something in retreat, though obviously transmission directly in person is far more powerful than through another medium, but it's a good way to have a little bit of a taste. And you can order the book there if you're interested in, you know, what I've had to say about my experience on the path and how it's worked for me. What else do I want people to know? Yeah, just, you know, it's really not anything you have to have a lot of experience for. You know, you could come to a retreat a weekend or, a day of a long retreat or, you know, any part of it without really knowing a great deal about this particular practice. It's something quite, you know, you just enter into it and you have your experience. So it's not for those who've done a lot of any one background.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's not even really for dancers per se.
Right,
it's really
right.
For people who want embodied mysticism.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. And when's your next movement monastery?
It's coming right up. It begins June 16th through the 29th, 2 weeks, and it's at Synergia Ranch, which is a fantastic, wonderful center outside of Santa Fe, a little bit south. And so, yeah, that's when it is. You can kind of look that up. If you go to the website, there's a link called Movement Monastery. That's what I call my retreat, the longer retreat.
Mm.
And it'll tell you about it.
Beautiful. You know, Dunya, I have just thoroughly enjoyed connecting with you about all of this tonight and your work and just really feeling you, and I really can feel the depth of what you're doing, and I so appreciate you taking the time to share with us in this Spirituality in Dance series, and it's just been a pleasure.
It's a total pleasure for me as well. Thank you so much for having me as your guest.
You're so welcome. And many blessings, everyone. And we'll be talking to you on June the 16th for our next interview. And thanks again, Dunya. Good night, everyone.
Your conference recording has stopped.